Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast, a podcast channel here on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkar, and more importantly, I have the pleasure today of speaking with Dr. Annie Rachel Royson, who is the author of a brand new Routledge publication, a fascinating work called Texts, Traditions, and Sacredness, Cultural Translation in Krista Purana. Annie, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Raj.
Without further ado, we have to put on the radar of our listeners this fascinating work about which your book dives into. Krista Purana. What is the Krista Purana?
The Krista Purana is a 17th century retelling of the Bible in the Marathi language. It has 10,962 verses, and was composed by an Englishman who came to the western coast of India in the late 16th century, lived and died here, and learned Marathi and its literary traditions well enough to be able to retell the biblical narrative in this beautiful OV meter, the meter that the same poets of Marathi were using at the time. And as you mentioned, it's a fascinating work. And I argue that it is the earliest translation of the Bible into a South Asian language, even though it's in poetic form. It is the first ever retelling that we have in a South Asian language. It's a fascinating work, and often people, when they hear that an Englishman came to India so early on during the Portuguese regime in Goa, and he learned Marathi well enough to be able to write a work of such epic proportions, of such literary beauty, they stop at that, and the attempt was to dive a little deeper into this text and learn what it could teach us about sacred text translation, about the literary traditions of the period, and so on.
Mm. Could you tell us a bit, at least what little bit we know of, a bit about this figure behind the work, something about his background or training or motivations, and what prompted him and enabled him to do this translation?
This has been one of my favorite topics to speak about for about a decade now. So I think people who know me are tired of listening to this.
Well, thankfully, you'll have many more people on the podcast who haven't heard you before. So you're in luck.
I'm so grateful. This book actually comes out of my doctoral research that I did at the Indian Institute of Technology, Gandhinagar. And when I was writing my thesis and later revising it to make it into this book, I wondered how much of Stevens I should put in his life. And I decided that it is important that we speak about Stevens and his life because it is critical to the way we understand the text as well. So as I mentioned, he was an Englishman. He was a Jesuit. And he was living in England at the time when the Catholics were being persecuted under Elizabeth's regime, and his dear friend Edward Pound was imprisoned, and he managed to go to Rome and joined the Jesuit order and studied the humanities before he was allowed to go to India for missionary work. He arrived in India in 1579. And in a letter to his father, he mentions, he describes a very eventful journey by ship how he landed on the coast of Goa. His early impressions, his first impressions of the locals that he met there, of the plants, I have a whole chapter on that, of the plants, of how the people spoke and dressed, very interesting Orientalist descriptions of the land and the people. So he was a fascinating figure. We have records that show that by 1594, he was fluent in the language and he was able to listen to confessions in lingua canari, that is in Konkani. So he was fluent in the language by then. So he was also one of the earliest people to notice the similarities between Sanskrit and Latin, the grammatical similarities, you know, something that would later become a whole field of study in linguistics. He was fascinated with the languages and the literary traditions of the region. The Jesuits also got some training in the local literary genre. So I'm sure they were required to read some Marathi poetry. So for example, his work is a lot more similar to Jnaneshwar's style. And Jnaneshwar wrote in the 13th century. And it's a lot more similar to Jnaneshwar's than his contemporary Tukaram, another Marathi saint poet. So that shows that, you know, he was reading these early Marathi poets and getting familiarity with their work. But however you look at it, he's an outlier because no one was doing a work of this kind, even among the Catholic priests in the Portuguese mission in Goa. He worked for a very brief time in what is now Bombay. No one was even attempting to retell the whole story of the Bible, most of the Old Testament and most of the New Testament. Other people were writing songs, writing catechisms, writing liturgies, translating a lot of church material from the West, but no one was attempting something of this order. So he's an unusual figure.
There are to my mind some profound implications on the fact that regarding the fact that he chose the Purana genre into which to render the narratives of Old and New Testament. And so do you want to say a quick word about the Purana genre and why do you think he might have chosen this idiom of expression?
Again, we have a whole chapter on that. As you see, chapter 3 is a discussion on the whole genre problem. My short answer would be because that was what the Marathi saint poets were doing. This was the age, what Sheldon Pollock has called the age of vernacularization, and different people have different terminology to talk about this early modern period in India. And a lot of literature was being translated from Sanskrit into the regional languages. And for Marathi as well, this was a very important period where Marathi was emerging as a literary language. That is what people like Jnaneshwar were doing. They were inaugurating this age where Marathi was evolving from being merely a spoken language to a literary language. It was coming into its own as a literary idiom. So the simple answer is that he was copying what the Marathi saint poets were doing. He was using that genre, because that is what the literate converts of Goa were used to reading. It's also important to note here that the people who were the early converts in Goa were Brahmins, as it is mentioned in the Krista Purana as well. And these were literate people who were banned from reading their old Puranas. So there is a verse where the listeners go to the Padri Guru, the narrator, and say, "You have banned the old Puranas, so what are we going to read now? Give us new Puranas." And so the Padri Guru decides very benevolently to, you know, write a new Purana for them. And even though it sounds all sweet and idealized here, it is true that these were people who had their old texts taken away from them. And in a sense, they were uprooted from their literary traditions, from their cultural traditions. And they were looking for roots, and they were attempting to understand this new faith that they were now finding themselves in, and in many instances forcefully. So this was an attempt. They were able to get the thrill of a new story in the familiar genre of the Marathi saint poets were using. But then I have also argued that the Purana itself is a genre that is open to what I call novelization in the book. It has spaces for new stories, new narratives, new voices to come in, and which is probably why these regional poets were all picking the Purana in the first place to tell their own stories, while also giving the story a certain validation and a sacredness in the literary tradition.
Brilliant. I typically play a naive podcast host. This is my dharma in this moment, but I'll toggle over into scholar mode just for a quick second. It just so happens that my area is Puranas and the epics, and without question, there is what confounds studies of the Puranas are the very notion of text and how we think of text and the orality and fluidity. You know, the Sanskrit Puranas are very much the residue of an organic paradigm. You know, arguably, which is only completed with the absent Puranika or someone to bring them to life. So, without question, I think it is the fluidity of the Puranas, and he must have grokked also. Yes, clearly, you know, this is a line that people are using. You know, this is a means of advertising. You know, let's use Facebook. Everyone's on Facebook. Let's use you know, Instagram. Everyone's on Instagram. Yes, clearly, but no, he's such a brilliant individual. He must have grokked what I think of as one of the core mandates of Purana, which is dissemination en masse of theological and philosophical ideas, and sort of just pitching them in unassuming, charming tales. So it's fascinating. Now, before I bore too much of our audience, I'll switch back into podcast to naive podcast host mode. I don't have Marathi, so I haven't been able at all to look at the text. So I wonder if you could comment a little bit on the world of the text and both the, you know, the quality and the beauty of the of his rendition, but also some of the decisions he makes. Are there particular aspects of the Bible that he emphasizes or de-emphasizes, he leaves out? You know, could you say a little bit about the world within the text for us?
Yes. That was one of the fascinating parts of this research for me, to see the decisions he made as a translator, because it's a dangerous task he's undertaking. And anyone who was, I have written about this in another paper, whether it's Jnaneshwar who's bringing the Bhagavad Gita into Marathi for the first time, or it is Stevens three centuries down the line who is retelling the Bible into Marathi, these people are all aware, and you can sense it in their text, that they're doing very dangerous work, especially since for Stevens, he had to get licenses from the church to be able to write it, print it, and we have letters where he's writing to the Superior General for typefaces in Marathi so that he could print it in the script of the region, which could not happen. This text, by the way, was first printed in Roman script. So it is a Marathi retelling of the Bible in Roman script. So
I find that so fascinating. It's mind-boggling, actually.
The complexities just keep piling on in this. And there were times during my doctoral research when my supervisor used to joke that of all the texts in the world, you have to choose the one with 10,962 verses. And
then you're at least as brave as this author who translates it.
Yes. So both of us thoroughly enjoyed the journey as well. But the complexities, the layers that you find while studying this text are mind-boggling. And Stevens obviously has conversion on his mind. And two things were happening. One, the forced conversions that happened during the early Portuguese regime. There was the horror of the Goan Inquisition that they were trying to live down. And then priests like Stevens, who were actually in the field, knew that these people's hearts were not converted. So now works like the Christa Purana are an attempt to convert the heart. So you have your baptized local, but what are you going to do with the unconverted heart? So here is a text where you write in the Lok Bhasha, and he says in the introduction, in the prose introduction, he says, Bhavartya Barveya Kristavanu, Hya Purana, Swamiya Jesu Krista, Tarakachi Katha Leliahe. And then he goes on to say, so he's saying, believers, good Christians, this Purana is a Purana of our Savior Jesus Christ. And then he goes on to say that I have not used the high Marathi. I have tried to use what the people speak, so it can make sense to more people. And this is also the OB meter. The OB meter is a very lilting, sing-song meter, so it's very easy to commit to memory. And there are records that this was also sung in churches. But you see Stevens's discomfort at several points in the text. For example, in the instance from the New Testament where Jesus turns water into wine, he goes into this long-winded justification of why wine is mentioned at all. And he talks about how in those countries, in cold countries, they drink wine. But in India, we don't have to because we have a lot of clean water. And it's a sort of long-winded justification.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I rarely interrupt my guests, but I find that profound because he's not just translating the words. He's imbibed the ethos of the land. And
yes.
He's grokked this. And I find that utterly fascinating to say.
It is fascinating. So there are instances like that. I will give one or two examples like this and then go to the Vaikuntha example. Or just examples where, you know, fig leaf is not translated as fig leaf, but as banana leaf, where, you know, Adam and Eve cover themselves with banana leaves, which practically makes more sense, but any Bible translator would. This has been done by other translators. For example, there's a Malay translation that did something similar. So this was a strategy of localization that a lot of translators were probably using at the time. So there are choices like that. And the most important decision for me, and that is for me, my favorite chapter on landscapes as well, the way the Goan landscape seeps into the biblical narrative. And that is one translatorial decision that fascinates me, and still haunted by it, still working on it in ways. And it was very difficult for me at the time to find a vocabulary to talk about this as well. So when you read the Christa Purana, you are unsure where you are. Am I in Palestine? Am I in Goa? What is this landscape? It is a mixture of biblical landscapes and Goan landscapes. So you have plants, trees, birds from Goa, and examples which makes this the story more believable to the local audience, which is listening to him. He says at the beginning of the Purana that this was told over a course of 52 Sundays. So for 52 Sundays, people kept coming back to the church, and the Padri Guru, the narrator, would tell the story. So ways of making the story riveting to his audience, as would any storyteller in any oral tradition, probably. One of the most beautiful scenes for me is when he describes the destruction of Jerusalem, when the people of Israel go back and they find their city burnt down, and a beautiful description of how the city is desolate, but all the plants and the snakes and the landscapes are Goan, and elements that the locals could identify with. But one particular translatorial decision that I spent some time on is Stevens's use of Vaikuntha. Vaikuntha, as you know, in the Puranic tradition, is the abode of Vishnu. But he translates Vaikuntha into the throne of the creator God, the Christian God. Very important and anxiety-inducing translatorial decision right there, where you translate the Christian heaven as Vaikuntha, and you cleanly remove Vishnu from the throne and place Christ as Vaikuntha Nayak in Vaikuntha. So that is one very important translatorial decision. But what is important is also what is left untranslated. So there is translatability and there is untranslatability. And untranslatability can be of two ways. One is where you're unable to find an equivalent term to translate something, and the other is where you refuse to translate something. And others like Vicent Raphael have written about it very profoundly in when he's talking about Tagalog Bible translation. So terms like Spiritu Santo, the Holy Spirit, or core terms that are related to church doctrine are left untranslated, either in Latin or in Portuguese. So in that sense, this text is also very multilingual. You find Marathi, you find Konkani, you find a bit of Portuguese, you find some Latin. In a sense, that is also a translatorial decision where untranslatability will stand guard against the dangers of translation. Because what you're doing by picking a genre like the Purana is you are submitting your true, in quotation marks, true Christian text to the generic features of the Purana. You're afraid that your story is going to transform, it's going to change when you're doing that. And so you need this kind of untranslatability to stand guard. And this kind of anxiety, the anxiety of the translators seen again in the Krista Purana is divided into two parts, the Pahile Purana and the Dusre Purana, roughly corresponding to the Old Testament and the New Testament, though Christ features very prominently even in the first Purana. So in the Dusre Purana, there is this scene where a wise Brahmin stands up and questions the Padri, and he says, "You've told us about limbo and how souls go into limbo and the things that the Lord of Vaikuntha told the angels, but how did you know? Who told you?" So it's a very simple question. Did you adorn the story poetically with your imagination? If you're doing that, how can we trust this book? So this is Stevens's own anxiety as a translator that he's trying to justify here. And then the Padri said, "Okay, good question. And I've understood your question. So now let me try to answer it." And he says, "The excellent scriptures don't have a speck of falsehood in it, but we embellish, like a painter uses beautiful colors in a painting. We embellish our story poetically to make it beautiful, to make it interesting for you. We're not like the poets or the Gentiles who compose their books waywardly, and we would not mix falsehood in it. But he's justifying his beautification of the text. He's justifying his the liberties that he's taken with the biblical narrative. So these are some of the examples I gave you of the translatorial decisions that he took. I don't know if I answered your question sufficiently, so feel free to.
Oh, the questions are always meant to be generative, and we'll just see where we end up. But great. It was a great discussion. One wonders, you know, one really wonders after this figure's view of biblical narratives, insofar as whether or not he sees them as what we might consider today something as along the lines of mythological or malleable or transplantable to different soil or using different idioms. It seems that there might be aspects of theological aspects that are to be preserved and fixed and not translated. And yet, by virtue of the liberties he takes, one wonders after how he views biblical narratives. It's fascinating, actually.
Yes, that is actually a very interesting question. For him, there is no doubt, and he says this in the prose introduction as well, that the Bible is the truth and Christ is the Savior. So, and he follows many of the conventions of the Marathi saint poets, where it begins with an invocation to God, and the saints follows the exact same poetic conventions that these Marathi saint poets were using. And then he writes this beautiful invocation to the Marathi language. He says, of all the languages of this land, I found Marathi most beautiful and most worthy. And those lines are beautiful. And anyone who's written even a line about the Krista Purana has reproduced it, compares Marathi to musk among perfumes and the mogra among flowers. So he says that Marathi is the most beautiful language, worthy of this kind of story. But he is very sure that when people read his Purana, they would know what the truth is and what is the only way to salvation. So for Stevens, it is very clear that this is a text meant to show the people that this is the only true way to mukti, to salvation, and they have to believe in Christ. But there are other problems that he's addressing through this as well. So he's using the biblical narrative to tell the people that you can use this to live your life. For example, there were people, the converts would not treated well by the Hindus who were not converted. They were called Bartlele, polluted people, and they had to face ostracization, a lot of problems from those around them. So he uses biblical examples. He uses the story of Joseph, various other biblical passages to tell them that, you know, if you bear suffering for the true path that you have chosen, this is like an ark which will take you to heaven. So you have to trust the process. So he's also using biblical passages to tell them that this idol worship you've been doing up until now, it is wrong and it will lead to destruction of your land. So he is trying to stay true to the biblical narrative, but he can't resist from time to time from using it to solve some of the practical problems of the new converts in the region.
Could you comment on the dialogical dimension of the Krista Purana?
It is dialogic. I didn't let you complete your question today.
No, that's fine. No, insofar as adopting the idiom of Puranas where there's always a questioner.
Yes.
You know, could you talk about his use of that throughout the Krista Purana, or is there a primary narrative? Are there multiple questioners? What does that look like?
Yes, there is the narrator, the Padri Guru, who's telling the story, but there are questioners who stand up from time to time. Like the example I gave you earlier of the wise Brahmin who asks him, where did you get the story from? There are multiple questioners who will stand up from time to time and ask a question about the Purana or ask for an explication, an explanation of the story that he has just told. Sometimes there are conversation between angels, two characters in the story. For example, when again, one of the most powerful passages in the Krista Purana, which I've also translated and put as an appendix in the book, where Lucifer is revolting and the other angels are telling him that he should remember where he came from and he should not commit this foolishness. So there are multiple questioners and the form is very dialogic. And the Padri Guru is in constant conversation with his listeners in the Krista Purana. And this also is important because often in this kind of sacred text translation, especially in colonial settings, the listener or the receiver of the translation is painted as this powerless, mute recipient who's sitting there and quietly receiving what the colonizer missionary has to give. But in the Krista Purana, you see a very, very dialogic format where the Padri Guru's story is forced to change because the questions that are asked. For example, there is one question that a Brahmin asks. He says, why are we being punished for Adam's sins? If Adam committed sin in the beginning, what is God and unjust? Why should we bear the brunt of it? And then this is a very interesting example from the caste system where he says that, you know, like a Brahmin will have Brahmin children and a Shudra will have Shudra children. So a sinful person will have sinful offspring. So see how casually caste is woven into the narrative. But it is the question from the local that brings in this color. It is an extremely dialogic text. It is dialogic also in the sense that the dialogue is between the genres. So it's dialogue between the genre of the Purana and the biblical tradition. So it's not dialogue just in terms of conversation between people, but the dialogue is also an encounter between these two very powerful traditions and what happens to the story when these two traditions encounter each other. And now that we're talking about caste, there is also a brilliant passage where the snake is described. The snake, Stevens' snake, is a resplendent, glorious creature, the colors that he has described. And it's important to remember that this Goa has a very, very powerful snake worshipping tradition. So this was also a way of saying that the snake is the evil one. It may look glorious and resplendent to you, but it is the symbol of all that is evil.
Do we have a sense of the reception or efficacy of this text?
Yes. So various people have written about, for example, there are letters the Jesuits have written when they're writing the official reports of the work done in Goa, where they say that Thomas Estevao has written this beautiful work. And not only the Christians, but the Hindus also speak of it with much pride. So we have letters like that. So it was received with much joy, even though we know from his letters that he struggled to get it printed in local script, and then it had to be printed in Roman script. It was very well received, and we know that because a lot of Christian Puranas began to be written after that. For example, Etienne de la Croix's Peter Purana and a slew of Puranas that came in the centuries after. So this began to be a model that was then emulated in the, especially in the Catholic missions after Stevens. And all Marathi and Konkani literary histories mention Krista Purana with a lot of reverence. Obviously, in the backdrop of the violence as well of the Portuguese administration, but all of them allude to its literary beauty. Even Protestant Bible translation histories mention the Krista Purana, that there was this beautiful text that poetically retold the Bible. So it's a strange situation where people have, they always mention it with a lot of reverence, but there are not many studies, or until recently, there have not been many studies. There was a doctoral work that was done in Rome in the 1940s, but no one has been able to trace it. There's Nelson Falcao's work. There's the doctoral thesis that S.G. Malshe wrote in the 1960s. And then we have more recent work from Sweden as well. So it's a strange fascination, but not many people have done very in-depth studies of the text. So it has always been revered. There's also a strange kind of invisibility when you go looking for Stevens in Goa and the text, because I think it's probably because the Portuguese later banned all regional texts, and that is probably when the singing of the Krista Purana might have stopped in the churches of the region. But it is said that the Christians of Mangalore used to sing it during the Shashti events of their children, and when Tipu Sultan imprisoned Christians in Seringapatnam, apparently they sang verses to stay strong through the imprisonment. So yes, it's been written about by all kinds of scholars over the
years. Drawing on the strength of the Krista Purana. your subtitle, the subtitle of your book is Cultural Translation in Krista Purana. Why cultural translation? Say a word about that.
That would again be a very dangerous thing to do, because in the field of translation studies, cultural translation is a term that causes much anxiety, and we're constantly fighting with each other about whether we should.
Luckily, generalizations are not only permitted but welcome on podcasts, so you're safe.
You might make me lose my job by talking about all this.
Actually, after this podcast, they may consider you for promotion or raise, so you'll
be fine. Okay. But this is a very, very, very problematic but also very interesting term, and I use this very consciously and deliberately, in spite of all the anxiety that it invokes among translation scholars. So the term cultural translation has been used in this text, my work, to make sense of the ways in which cultural encounters and negotiations happen in the mission field, and how this cultural encounter gave rise to texts like the Krista Purana. So when you say cultural translation, I use it because it enables us to foreground, to emphasize the cultural aspect, the aspect of cultural encounter that leads to the composition of texts like the Krista Purana. So these are not mere linguistic transpositions. These are texts that are a result of many, many, many complex cultural negotiations. The way knowledge travels, for example, the story of how the printing press came to the region as well. Priyolkal writes about it, and I have reproduced it in this book. So the Krista Purana is also one of the earliest printed works in South Asia. It has that distinction as well. So this was a printing press which was meant to go to Ethiopia. But for some reason, the priest who was in charge, they had to stop at Goa, and the priest died here in Goa, so the printing press stayed. So a lot of interactions, cultural interactions and encounters, which created the conditions necessary for the composition of a text like this. And the fact that these priests had to find ways, strategize and find ways of talking to the hearts of the localites. And for that, they had to submerge themselves in the culture of the region. They could not speak from a distance. By speaking from a distance, you could have forced conversions. But if you really wanted these people to be Christians, then you had to speak to their hearts. And for that, the Lok Bhasha was needed. For that, an immersion into the culture was needed. So long before the Catholic Church adopted the term inculturation, people like Stevens were doing this through cultural translation. So I use cultural translation to foreground what people like Thomas Stevens were doing to bridge the gap between these very diverse cultures, and in the process come up with something completely new, a third thing that never existed before.
Yeah, absolutely. The term resonates. I mean, outside of the whatever that means for specialists, the term resonates in common parlance insofar as the brilliance of Stevens, to my mind. You know, my conversation with you, I really rarely, never really mention other podcasts during podcasts, but I had a conversation with Frank Clooney on a work called St. Joseph in South India. So it was sort of a parallel situation where I think the figure's name was Beshi, wrote a work in Tamil.
Yes.
And yes. What strikes me, the brilliance of such people, why I find it fascinating is not just as a scholar, but someone who understands or tries to understand people and culture. And what's fascinating is that his brilliance is not just the intellectual acumen to learn a language or the poetic skill to render, you know, render tales in verse, in a, et cetera. It's that figures such as Stevens is astute to a cultural paradigm that they are able to digest. They take in, they don't throw it up. They take it in, they digest it. They chew their cud, so to speak, right? They're able to produce something from it. They are changed by the process.
Absolutely.
And they are open to that transformation. And it's fascinating because similarly, we have in Indic culture, we have, you know, the fixity of the Vedic revelations and then the utter fluidity of the Puranas. You know, they are fixed and anchored in their theological and spiritual convictions, and yet they're open to the fluidity and transformation of culture. And they're reaching people that they grok this salient truth that even if you succeed in converting people in terms of their religious beliefs, you're not going to convert them culturally. This is not going to happen. So you have to, however you want to think of it, whether you think of it as Trojan horsing or you think of it in a more benign way. But I really think that, to my mind, what's so fascinating about such figures is their knowledge, their instinctive knowledge of people and culture, in addition to their intellectual knowledge.
Absolutely. And I completely agree. And I use transformation quite a bit. And other scholars have written about this as well, of how people like Stevens, or Beshe for that matter, and Francis Cloney has done wonderful work with Roberto De Nobili as well, of how these people were even transformed physically in their process of living here. It's so they have to first be transformed in their bodies and mind before they're able to compose something of this stature. Mm. And because we are talking about transformation here, I will add a point which will also add to what we were saying about cultural translation. Cultural translation also enables us to bring to the discussion South Asian ideas of what translation, the process itself, looks. So non-Western ideas of translation, because in the Indian subcontinent, translations have been around for a long time, but we never really theorized about it as seriously as scholars in the West did. And for us, translations could be retelling. It could be translation. It is speaking after. So using the term cultural translation is also a very conscious way of saying that this is a very geographically rooted way of translating, a culturally rooted way of translating that leads to the eventual transformation of the text. As well, the text no longer remains the same. As E.V. Ramakrishnan writes, the text then just remains a pretext and you come up with something completely new.
Well, you know, I really appreciate that you point to a very different approach to both text and translation in the South Asian context. You know, it's fascinating. I was... long story short, I ended up writing a public book recently called The Stories Behind the Poses, where I'm telling vignettes from the epics and Puranas. And it's so difficult to convey to folks that somebody's tellings are, direct translations and synopses and condensations. Clearly, these tellings will include embellishments and references even to the modern world. Yes. And that it's not... that it's a feature, not a bug, that these are renderings.
Yes.
And thereby they retain their relevance to whatever historical paradigm.
Absolutely. Or as Stephen says, you're adding color to your painting and that should be allowed. Mm. Or as per South Asian translation traditions, that is how we've always retold and translated.
So one final question for today. What do you hope folks would take away from this book?
That is a difficult one to answer. You've saved the difficult one for the end.
Let's say what would you say if there is an argument, what's the gist? I'm sure they'll take away a great many themes and experiences. It's a rich, rich work on a rich work. But how would you characterize the work that the book is doing, would you say?
One, that the Krista Purana is the earliest retelling of the Bible in a South Asian language. And often because it was in poetic form, translation scholars have sort of ignored that possibility. And we have to keep that in mind while studying the history of Bible translation in the subcontinent. Second, the sacred texts are important, especially when you're studying a region like South Asia. And people often dismiss it for its non-scientific nature or whatever it is people dismiss it for. And my argument is that you cannot study a region such as South Asia without studying its sacred texts, especially because we have such a beautiful, complex, rich textual traditions, and we have to take those into account. So a text like Krista Purana, with so many intersecting themes, you know, there's sacredness, there's genre, there's colonialism. When you study these texts, you are able to look deeply into how translation functions, how genre transformed over space and time. And I hope that the readers will take away from my book that sacred texts ought to be studied with seriousness. The last chapter of the book is also important, where I talk about the transformation of landscapes, where, you know, as the literary landscapes are transforming in these texts, the actual geographical landscapes of these regions are also transforming. New kinds of buildings are coming up, new kinds of crops are being grown. The way the people relate to the land changes in this process as well. I'm saying that translation can also be used as a critical lens, and the study of translated works from South Asia can be used as a critical lens to understand this region much better, understand how it evolved, why we are the way we are. And I hope that scholars will take these sacred texts and translations much more seriously when they think about the region.
Fantastic. Thank you for appearing on the podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me, Raj.
For those listening, we have, of course, been speaking with Dr. Annie Rachel Royson on this fascinating new Routledge publication, Texts, Traditions, and Sacredness, which itself is on this fascinating work that translates the Bible into Marathi, into poetic verse as a Purana. I have no idea how that happened, but I'm glad that it did, because this has been an excellent conversation. Until next time, keep well, keep listening, and keep contemplating the complexities and power of translations, literary, cultural, and otherwise. Take care.